Hey, what's up? This is Christian with the Most High Show, and today we are using technology to our advantage. We are reaching far across the states through the golden lands of America into Mississippi. Yeah, and Jared is here with us. Jared is 10 years living a life of recovery. He has a wife and three kids. He owns his own business and where he works with people in and through recovery. He has a faith-based curriculum, Christ-centered curriculum that he's created. And I'm really excited to hear his story, share that with you, and hopefully it brings hope and strength to you in your life and your own walk in recovery. This is The Most High Show. Welcome to The Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and the 12 steps. Produced, hosted, and posted by people in recovery who've been given strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is The Most High Show. That's the intro, and here we go. All right, Jared, what's up, man? Thank you so much for being here with us.
Hey, thanks for having me on. It's a blessing.
Yeah. It's really cool the way we've been using technology and Instagram and all those things to start reaching out and connecting with people. And one of the biggest blessings I get from the show is I get to meet people like you, everybody in this room. I've you know, most of them are met through this platform, and so really blessed to do this and have you on. So give me a little snippet of what's a day in the life of Jared today? What's that like?
All right, day in the life today. So I wake up about 6 o'clock in the morning. I have farm animals. I live out on about 60 acres now. I have goats and chickens that I'm raising, and I'm new at this. I just started doing it last year. So I'm up with them early, and I have a garden, and I go out there and I get with the Lord right away before I get into my phone and before I get into any phone calls or even essentially even communicating with my kids and my wife. I'll get out and I'll kind of talk to God for about 20 or 30 minutes before I get on to my work day.
And when you get to your work day, what's that day? What do you do for a living?
Okay, so I'm an addiction counselor. So what I do when I first get in the morning is I kind of go through my calendar and I look at what I have before me. And then I'll meet up with people. I meet up with people and do individual counseling. And then when I can, behind me, you'll see the corner of a green screen. Yeah. I have a little studio back there. And so whenever I get the time, I jump back there and I start working on my courses. So all my curriculum that I've created, I'm in the process of putting it all online.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. Yeah, right. So it's kind of going to be like an on-demand, like as they need it, they can get access to some resources.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, that's cool. Now, life wasn't always goats, chickens, and sunrises, right?
No.
So tell me about like the first time that drugs or alcohol solved an issue for you.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Yeah. So it was right off the bat when I was 6 years old, I started getting into dipping tobacco and smoking cigarettes. And that issue for me was fitting in with the older kids and trying to be cool, you know. So I immediately, hey, this makes me fit in. This makes me cool. And I'd ride my bike down to the gas station and I'd get dip and cigarettes for all the older kids and bring them back. And, you know, I was a hero.
Ah, yeah, right. Yeah, that's interesting. Like there's a lot of that sense of belonging early age, right? We want to belong somewhere, right?
So no doubt.
Did you feel like, you know, even at that young age that you didn't belong before that?
Yeah, there was definitely something off. You know, I always wanted to hang out with the older kids, and you know, the older kids always gave me heck. That's what they do. They tease the younger kids. And so there was a very much a sense of trying to prove myself, trying to prove them wrong, trying to prove my worth to them, and all mixing up, trying to find my way in the world. And that was the way that I thought was my way.
Yeah. So at what point did you realize that, you know, maybe things are getting out of hand? Maybe you had a problem.
I'd say early in my teenage years, when I'd say 11, 12 years old, I was willing to try anything that came across. I was popping pills, you know, getting into ecstasy, LSD, mushrooms, and all that. And so I knew that there was an issue because I was so willing to do anything that was harmful for me.
Yeah. We have a dog freaking out over here.
Okay.
This real life. This is, it looks like a studio, but we have our own farm animals over here. Yeah, I think he was freaking having a dream or something. He was having a using dream.
I must have triggered him with my story.
So now tell me, though, I mean, what's your family life like during that time? Is mom and dad around? What's that like?
So my mom and dad, you know, they're great people. They're hard workers. My mom and dad are workaholics. So very much always working. Work came first. I developed this sense of, I think this problem with authority from a young age, and I don't know if it stemmed from the butt whippings that I had. I mean, they were relentless. It was pretty much a daily thing for me. And in my mind, I was a bad kid. I mean, that was what I grasped. I wrapped onto being, I was bad. I needed my ass whipped on a daily basis. And I think that, I don't know if that's what stemmed my problem with authority. And that was then it triggered from there. It just stemmed out to any authority at all. So,
right.
And that including God, you know, the ultimate authority.
Yeah. That's interesting. Something about, being accepted as you were, right. And feeling like that you were flawed. Something was wrong with you.
Yeah.
So you start, you know, that's a lot like my story, you know, starting off with the hallucinogens and, you know, so in the beginning, it doesn't start off as a, some might think is an issue. In the beginning, it seems like fun, right? But there was a point that you said at that age where things started getting out of control because you knew, recognized that you were willing to try and do anything.
Oh, yeah. And sure, anybody that was trying to tell me anything different was just trying to rain on my parade. You know, they didn't know. I had all the answers. Nobody could tell me anything. I'm definitely like hard-headed as they come. So ended up having to learn everything in recovery the hard way too. But once I learn it, I get it. It's in there. So I'm grateful to be where I'm at today, but it was tough. I developed from that problem with authority. It was like a very much a clown kind of mentality in school, stopped taking school seriously. Didn't really have a clue what life was about. It was about serving myself it was very hedonistic. I was just looking for anything to fill that void inside me. And I tried to fill it with anything and everything. It didn't work.
Right. So at what point when's the first time that you tried to get clean or to stop using?
The first time I attempted, I was 18 years old. I had just gotten my first sale of a controlled substance felony, and the judge gave me the option because I was already on pretrial diversion from a previous 4 felony charges when I was 17. And the judge gave me an option. He said, you can go to rehab or you can go to the penitentiary. Well, you know, I chose rehab. It was an easy choice. I wasn't ready. Mm-hmm. It was a 30-day place, and I went and got my 30 days and went right back out way further down than I had ever been before. And that's whenever I started using intravenously after that.
Yeah. Wow. So you start using intravenously, and what starts following after that? I mean,
oh gosh, it took my disease to a whole new level of despair. I mean, just the things that I would do, there was nothing I wouldn't do to get high at that point. And then, I mean, I was chasing something I would never reach. I would end up, you know, locking myself in a bathroom for days, sometimes weeks, with no sleep. I mean, I'd stay up for 10 days at a time, and I would literally start coming unglued. My mind, it was amazing to me that I survived that. My body would be trying to shut down from lack of food and sleep, and I'd keep going. It was nothing that was going to stop me, you know?
Yeah. Wow. You know, as you're saying that, I'm just, it, you know, it does, you said triggered, right? It doesn't trigger me, but it evokes memories and reminds me of those days. Because I started using meth at a younger age too, around 13, 14, and did that up until about 18, 19. And in some ways, I'm glad I did my meth days young. because there are some people that I know that started using meth in their 30s and they lost everything very quickly. But I remember those multiple days up, and you start seeing things, you start hearing things. We used to try to tag. That was our thing, is we would do graffiti. And yeah. It's hard to do graffiti when you're spun out because you keep hearing cars coming, and there ain't no cars coming, but you see in headlights and you're hearing cars and you're like, I can't paint because someone's coming and ain't nobody coming.
That'd be nerve-wracking experience.
Right. So you have the right idea locked inside of a bathroom, right?
Yeah, but I use those experiences and I keep them in my back pocket. You know, in early recovery, defeating that impulse was a huge thing, as everybody probably listening knows. It's that impulse, overcoming that impulse in our own mind is probably the hardest thing to overcome.
Right.
So for me, I keep all those miserable experiences right in my back pocket, because anytime I ever get an impulse or a fleeting thought comes across, I pull those out and I walk back down. I bring myself right back into those miserable times. I say, this is what's going to happen. If I were to give in to this impulse, I'm going to end up right back here doing these things. And then by the time I go back through that and visualize it all in my mind, no, I don't want any part of that. I'm okay.
Well, that's a lot of what the 12 steps about, and a lot about what your work is today, right? I mean, you're working with people young in recovery, early in recovery. And so I imagine you see yourself in them, and sometimes, and that helps you to know that. Because at 10 years, right, I just recently celebrated 8 years. You know, there's
congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, it is. It's huge. But I think that there is, like, maybe a year or two ago, there were times when I stopped. I took for granted that I was going to bed sober, you know.
Yeah.
Though I had to be reminded, you know, and God did a great job of doing that in the most loving and gentle way he could have to remind me that, hey, when I go to bed sober and I wake up sober, that those are wins. Like, I'm already starting the day in victory. Like, everything else is an add-on to life, you know? And so, and I did, I lost perspective of that around year five or six. I lost perspective that those were substantial wins in my life, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So,
man, you can't, those moments, you know, I have a scripture on the wall here, James 1:25, mm-hmm. resist the craving by counting the cost. That's mm-hmm. what you do. Count that cost, go back through those times and where that's going to lead to, add it all up, and you're going to realize you don't want to be a part of that equation anymore.
Right. So what happened 10 years ago that worked and that got you onto this path of recovery, of continuous conscious contact with God, you know, of a great relationship with your family, and living a full life that you live in today? I mean, what happened then that shifted?
Okay. The shift was definitely inside me. So my first son was in utero, and I was on a cooking crystal meth spree. I couldn't stop cooking meth. I knew where I was headed to, and I knew I had, you know, law enforcement after me, and I just couldn't stop doing it. Actually, matter of fact, I've never put myself into a detox before. I've always just gone through withdrawals. I went and locked myself in a detox for the first time because I couldn't stop cooking meth, and I knew I needed to. It was that powerful of a thing that had me, and a whole nother addiction to me in itself. When I was locked up for this charge, I was in there with about 80 other meth cooks, and they were all talking the same stupid stuff. Like, let's go out and do the same. Who can cook the best meth? Let's go out and do these crimes, to all this stuff. I got so sick of hearing it. I was just fed up with it. I said, you know, I got to separate myself from these people, even though I'm locked in here with them. So I started doing Bible study with a group of gentlemen. And I still do that today. And I started writing, something I still do today. And then I started working out with this other guy. Those three things I still do today. And the biggest being that contact with God. I have to keep a close contact with him all throughout the day. I mean, even if I forget to pray when I'm going home at night to be a good husband and father, then I might slip up when I get home and have some kind of misplaced anger, even though I had an amazing day. So I got to stay connected all day long.
Right. So you didn't go to a rehab or a treatment or?
Not for my last time. No, I've been to three different treatment centers before. I've been to one when I was 22. I went for 30 days and I signed up for another 6 months because I knew I needed it. So I was out there in California and sober living by the sea for 7 months and ended up getting 10 months before relapsing and going back even further down after that for another 2 years.
Yeah. So there was a point for you, something like you said, it was an internal shift, I guess, knowing your son was coming, knowing that life was going to shift and change, that inside of you, you made a decision.
Yeah. Yeah. To separate myself from that life, from those people, that life and everything involved in it. It had to be, everything had to change for me at that point.
So did you mentioned earlier that the 12 steps did have play a part in your recovery. At what point did you begin that journey?
So I was introduced at that first treatment center when I was 18. And then when I was 22 and I wanted to go back into treatment on my own that time. It wasn't a judge ordering me. I actually wanted it. I had had enough when I was 22 years old. I got into the steps. I did 120 meetings in 90 days. I got a sponsor and I worked those steps rigorously. And my sponsor opened my eyes up to openness and honesty and being open and honest with everyone in my life and what that's going to do for me in my recovery. And it still rings true today. I have to remain an open book, not a shame, no lies. If I tell one little lie, I'm opening the door to the enemy to come in and say, oh, hey, I hear a little lie. Let's come in and drop some big lies and see what happens, you know?
Yeah. So, the only lie I tell on a regular basis is when I go to the gas pump and it asks me if this is a debit card, I always say no. And it is a debit card. So I'm technically lying, but I just don't want to go through the process of putting in a pin and doing the whole thing.
Yeah.
That's the only one I tell now.
Well, you're lying to a machine. I don't know. Does that even count?
Right. yeah. So that's awesome. And I like that the way you said that, you know, because I do think that there is something about what the 12 steps offers and the ability, not only the ability, but placing the importance of that rigorous honesty, you know, of being real and being honest. And part of my own journey is, you know, I feel like, and this is my own, this is not to any fault of any program, but, you know, in primarily working a religious program in the beginning, there were things about my story that I hid, 10% of it, you know, that were just, I felt like I didn't want to confess that to a bunch of Christians, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And again, that's not to the fault of that program or those people. It was my own thing. Right. But recently, to dig that last 10% up and get rid of it, you know, the freedom I've experienced has been huge from that, and it is, man, that rigorous honesty, man. And then it's taken, for me personally, it's taken the shame and the guilt that I felt that was kind of not allowing me to be myself, because, you know, I was believing that lie that if you really knew me, you know, you wouldn't like me. And so I had this kind of constant filter on, and finally to be free of that shame and guilt, the filter is gone. And so I'm able to be more honest. And then when I'm honest, and in most cases, you know, it's not as spiteful or vengeful as my brain would think it's going to be. It actually is helpful and edifying to myself and others. So yeah.
It just permeates to everybody else in your life, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So now I want to know a little bit about, you know, you mentioned the Lord. So, yeah. Jesus is in your life.
Yeah. Yeah. Very much so. So
talking about that, when did you meet our homie Jesus?
So I'll tell you exactly how it happened. Now, I was always raised in church, raised in the Word. My mom, very, very devout Christian in her faith. And so she had the seed planted from a very young age for me. And I'm so grateful today for that. Now, this is the way it unfolded for me. After I worked those 12 steps and in their entirety, once I rigorously completed them for the first time, that's life was great. It was grand. And I fell away, though. I got 10 months clean, and then I relapsed, and I fell hard. I had to numb myself from all this information I was learning, all this 12-step work. It was going to take extra drugs to numb me from all that.
Yeah.
So what happened was I was sitting in my apartment, in my wife's apartment in California. I lived in an apartment below hers, and she had an apartment above me. I was sitting in her apartment, and I had never flushed any dope before in my life. But I got a bag of meth out there, and it scared me so much that I flushed it. And I went and sat back on the couch. And at the time, I wasn't even using it. It was like a next day type thing. I was like, oh, I don't want any more of that. I got to flush it. And I went and sat on the couch. And I can only describe it like this. Just waves of raw emotion just started flowing through my body, just pulsing like over and over. And I didn't know what was happening to me, but tears just started streaming down my face, just flowing. Yeah. And my wife's sitting there, and I'm like, I don't know what's happening to me. She's like, I don't know what's happening to you either. And I was like, well, I don't know, but it feels good. I told her that much. So it felt amazing. It was just, like I said, just flowing through my body, these waves of raw emotion. That's the only way I can describe it. Mm-hmm. And I finally, after about 10 or 15 minutes of this, I went and stood up in the kitchen, and I was leaning over on the kitchen counter. I was staring at this tile on the ground, and I said, I kind of felt like this warm embrace. And at that point I knew that it was God, and my teardrops were, my vision was all blurred up, and my tears came together and they dropped down to the floor, and the tile that I was staring at on the floor, I saw Jesus in that tile, clear as day. And I don't care if people think I'm crazy for telling this story or anything like that, that this happened and it was the real deal. And, the amazing part about all this is I turned my back on God after that I went out for another 2 years after that. And every time I felt like I was slapping God in the face, I knew he had called me to do something greater than myself with my life. Uh-huh. And I ignored him. I heard him, but I wasn't obeying. And that was a big thing for me. And then I'll share this real quick. Just a few months back, 33 years old now, it's happened all over again, except this time I knew. And I was sitting out with my chickens one evening, just me, just kind of reflecting on the day and talking to God. And the same thing happened. Just tears just started flowing. And that time I knew. And I said, I'm going to enjoy this, God. Tell me what you need to tell me. And he was just, it was kind of a reassuring message of keep doing what you're doing. Do this right. Do it slowly, surely, and methodically. You're doing my work, you know, kind of reassuring me with my business and everything that I'm working on now, that I'm doing his will. And it gave me the confidence to go forward each day and start my day off by saying, God, what do you need me to do today? Put it on my plate. And he kind of lines up my days for me now.
Wow. Yeah, that's huge. Yeah. So many things right there to unpack. But what a beautiful image, right? That out of your tears, out of your suffering, out of your pain comes Jesus, right? That there Jesus is in your suffering, in the tears of your suffering, right? And I think that's a beautiful imagery of what and who Jesus is to me and to so many people, that Jesus is there when we suffer, right? And suffers alongside us and with us. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
And then the patience and kindness and lovingness that comes along that you know, even though you kind of went back out, but here you are years and years later, that you're giving that experience again to reassure you, right? That's really powerful. And that's your spiritual awakening, right? That's your spiritual experience. You know, hate is gonna hate, but
you know, I don't care. Like I've lived a long time being a lukewarm Christian, and it got me nowhere. Jesus did not have kind words to say about lukewarm Christians either. And I want to represent him. You know, this is what all Jesus has done for me. I don't want to sugarcoat that part or beat around the bush. I want to give people the same kind of experience that I had. And it's never going to be from a like holier than thou place. I genuinely want them to have this experience and to know God like I know God. And he's revealing himself more each day to me. And I'm going back like a fiend. I'm fiending for the Lord now today. I'm like, Lord, I need my next fix. I want to feel the Holy Spirit every day for the rest of my life.
So how would you say the 12 steps has helped you to be a better Christian?
So the 12 steps are an active thing. I mean, as you know, you all know that it doesn't stop. There's always going to be work to be done. And the 12 steps have pointed out to me that I'm never going to get to this pinnacle moment where it's like, okay, I'm as good as I'll ever be, you know? So to me, it's being open, honest, constantly searching for my weaknesses so that I can improve on them, on my character defects, on my flaws, and I can become, you know, my greatest strengths all came from identifying and working on my biggest weaknesses. So I'm going to continue doing that. There's always going to be chinks in the armor that I need to work on and reinforce.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the 12 steps.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I mean, I think like they're tools for living. And yeah. A friend of mine, Dan, says that, you know, the 12 steps, he says controversially, he says the 12 steps aren't to get you off of drugs and alcohol. The 12 steps are to teach you how to help get somebody else off of drugs and alcohol. And I thought that this is a profound understanding of them, because that call, that ability to go help other people, like what you're doing professionally and personally, it's huge. It's, you know, it makes it worth it. And like you said, it takes those, the pains of our past, the, you know, all those things and all those wrongs, and it gives them purpose because we know that we can use them now. Like you said, keep it in the back pocket. I'm sure that there are times when you're sitting with someone and you're able to pull back a story or an experience that's similar to that person. And when they feel that, they know they're not alone, you know, and here's somebody who's alive and living and thriving in sobriety. And it gives them hope, man, maybe I can one day get to that point.
Yeah, getting out of self, that's everything. We are the, you know, our disease had us these selfish beings. I mean, that's what we were. We were very self-serving. Everything was very much always about ourselves. So it's getting out of that is a huge part of it. And those 12 steps, that's what they're all about, is helping guide people to get them out of it. See, the enemy wants to keep people like us in the darkness. He wants to pump our head full of these fears and doubts. Yeah. We're not good at it. We're never going to help anybody else. But that's very much all lies. We're the ones that need to get out and shine. You know, God made us to shine brightly for him in this dark world. And we have to just overcome that fear and doubt. And then we can be huge voices for other people and really help people out of that mud instead of, you know, how we used to lead people towards it.
If you had something to say, you know, words of encouragement, if somebody is on the other end of this and they're listening to us and they're on that cusp, they're thinking about, you know, trying this way of life, what encouragement do you have for that person?
Keep trying, keep getting back up every day. And if I could do this thing, you can do it. No doubt. Anybody can. The biggest thing for me is something that I'm just now starting to understand. I think the Lord carried me through my first few years in recovery, because I really wasn't working on my relationship with God. My biggest thing I want to tell people, I think today, is that God just wants to get to know you. He wants you to want to know him. And whenever he sees us making that effort to try and get to know him, to genuinely want to know God, he's going to start revealing himself in some big ways, some stuff you could have never imagined possible here in this earth with our worldly minds. We just can't grasp the things that God is capable of until he starts showing himself to us. And he does that when he sees our dedication and commitment to wanting to get to know him with all of our heart, soul, mind, and body. Everything we got, we put it to God now, just like we used to get our drugs.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Used to have hope that the dope man had dope.
Hope dealers, huh?
Right. Now our hope is placed in something greater and something bigger. And that's so true. Thank you so much for your testimony, for sharing it, for being so open and honest about it, and for the great work that you're doing, man.
You too, buddy. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for all your great work, too.
Yeah, thanks. Cool. Well, that's it. That does it for today on the Most High Show. Thanks for listening. And I want to do this before we tune out. If they want to get a hold of you, if anyone's in your area, or if anything that you've said has resonated with them, what's the name of your website?
So my website, they can go to escapeaddiction.net.
Okay.
And they'll be able to see all of my course layout, and my course outline is on there with a little snippet from each course, so they can kind of get an idea a little bit about what they're going to get into there. And then if they want to reach me, they can call me. I got all my numbers, my email, website, and I'm now Skype. I do Skype counseling sessions with people online too. So if they don't want to come in person or they live far away from me, we can still make it happen for them too. So all that will be accessible through my website, escapeaddiction.net.
All right. And again, you can always reach us, contact@themosthighshow.com, contact@themosthighshow.com. And we can help wherever we can. So thanks for listening. And that's it. Thanks.